Rosemary, have the right to kick our asses over stuff like this. Because not passing inspections or getting grounded over unpaid invoices is every bit as much trouble for this crew as anything else. Unpaid invoices won't suck you into space, mumbled Kizzy. You know what I mean, said Sissix. Kizzy sighed. Rosemary, I'm sorry for being a jerk, she said, looking at her toes. She lifted up her block of soap as if she were paying homage to royalty. Please accept my soap as an apology. Rosemary gave a little laugh. It's no problem, she said, relieved that she hadn't been perceived as a jerk. Keep your soap. Kizzy considered this. Can I buy you lunch at least? Really, it's okay. Let her buy you food, said Sissix. Otherwise, she's going to come up with some other ridiculous gift out of penance. Hey, you like the 12 days of jam cakes, Kizzy said. That I did, said Sissix. I almost wish you'd break my squib more often. Knocked it into a pot of soup, Kizzy confessed to Rosemary, and stuck her arm in after it, said Sissix, out of reflex, and spent the next hour in the med bay getting her burns treated. Whatever, you got jam cakes, stop being mean. Sissix pointed at Rosemary's squib. We need anything else in the district before we eat. Rosemary scrolled through the list. I don't think so. Didn't you say you wanted some scale scrub? Yeah. I didn't like what he had, though, Sissix said. Mind if we keep looking? The three crewmates drifted from stall to stall, inquiring after scale scrub. After several apologetic no's, one puzzled look, and one long-necked Laru who swore that his holistic desert salts would work just as well, Kizzy tugged on Sissix's vest. I bet that lady's got some, she said, pointing. Where? Said Sissix, turning around. Her face softened when she saw the merchant, an old Andrisk woman, seated beneath a small woven canopy, surrounded on three sides by tables full of handmade goods. The woman's feathers were faded, their frills worn and sparse. Her skin was cracking, like old leather, and though the single garment she wore, a soft pair of trousers, was bright and clean, something solemn hung around her scaled shoulders. Sissix said something to herself in Reskitkish. The sibilant words were lost on Rosemary, but she saw Kizzy's eyebrows knit together. Sissix pressed a palm towards her companions. Sorry, ladies. Wait here. I'll try not to be long. She headed for the merchant, who was too busy stirring a cup of something hot to see Sissix approach. Rosemary and Kizzy looked at one another. Do you know what she said? Rosemary asked. My Reskitkish sucks, Kizzy said, but she sounded upset. Don't know what she's up to. She nodded at a nearby bench. Guess we'll chill for a bit. They took a seat. Across from them, the merchant looked up at Sissix. The old Andrisk smiled, but she looked hesitant, as if she were embarrassed about something. Rosemary could see Sissix's mouth moving, but the words were lost to distance. Not that Rosemary could understand the language anyway. As Sissix spoke, her hands weaved in subtle patterns, shifting and darting like small flocks of birds. The old woman's hands moved in response. At first, their respective motions were discordant, but as their conversation continued, they began to mirror one another. Do you know Andrisk can speak? Rosemary asked. Kizzy glanced up from the lock of hair she was braiding. Not really. Sis taught me a couple of them, just basic stuff. Hello, thanks. I enjoy your company, but I don't want to have sex. She watched Sissix and the merchant for a moment. She shook her head. I have no idea. They're way too fast. But Sissix is speaking out loud, too, which is interesting. Why would she speak if she's using sign language? No, it's not like a sign language. Hand speak doesn't match up with Reskitkish. Rosemary was puzzled. This is a stupid question, but then what is it? Is it like facial expressions? Or hand-toe gestures? No. Kizzy pulled a ribbon from her pocket and tied off the braid. Hand speak expresses things that are either too basic to waste words on or too personal. Too personal? Yeah, stuff that's really important or hard to say. Like about love or hate or stuff you're scared about. You know how when you have something big to tell someone, you stammer through it or sit in front of your mirror practicing what to say? Andrisks don't bother with that. They let the gestures take care of all the awkwards. They figure that big, deep feelings are universal enough to be defined with just a flick of the hand or whatever, even though the events that cause those feelings are unique. That must save them a lot of time, said Rosemary, wondering how much of her life had been spent trying to find the right words in difficult conversations. Seriously. But back in the day, you could also use handspeak while you spoke. It was used to add emphasis to stuff you said out loud, so that folks knew you really meant it. Sissick says you can still use it like that, but it's old-fashioned, and you only do it in special circumstances. She nodded toward the stall, where the two Andrisks were now moving in sync. What we're seeing here is Sissick's being super respectful and honest. But she doesn't know that merchant, right? Dunno. Don't think so. But that lady's old, so maybe she's just being old-fashioned for her sake. Rosemary watched the Andrisks. Their hands moved in a graceful, hurried dance. How are they matching each other? She asked. Kizzy shrugged. I guess they agree on something. Her eyebrows shot up. Oh, like that. Sissix had sat down with her back against one of the tables, spreading her legs to either side. The older woman joined her, leaning her back against Sissix's front. They adjusted their tails accordingly. The old woman leaned her head into Sissix's chest, her eyes falling shut. Sissix pressed one palm against the old woman's stomach, holding her close. With her other hand, she spread her fingers wide and ran them up from the old woman's scalp to the tips of her feathers, tugging the shafts gently as she went. To human eyes, they looked like reunited lovers behind a bedroom door, not at all like two strangers in an open-air market. Even across the street, the old woman's face was easy to read. She was in bliss. Rosemary was bewildered. She knew Andrisks were uninhibited, by human standards, she reminded herself, but this went beyond what she was expecting. She said, so I have no idea, said Kizzy. Andrisks, I don't even fucking know. She was silent for a few seconds. Do you think they're gonna go for it? She whispered, leaning forward with childlike curiosity. I bet they are. Holy shit. Is that even legal here? Oh, I hope they don't. But the Andrisks did not couple. Though they continued their spontaneous intimacy for a good half hour, stroking feathers and nuzzling cheeks, oblivious to the stares of passers-by. At one point, two other Andrisks strolled past without more than a casual glance, as if nothing was going on. Rosemary wasn't sure if she should avert her eyes or not. Sissix clearly didn't care who was looking. As Rosemary watched, the peculiarity of the act began to melt away. It was alien, yes, and sudden, but not uncomfortable. There was a weird sort of beauty to it. Something about the way their hands moved, the ease with which they touched each other. Baffling as the thought was, Rosemary found herself a little envious. Of the old woman, or of Sissix, she wasn't sure. She wished someone would give her that sort of attention on a whim. She wished she were confident enough to give it back. Finally, there was a flutter from the old woman's hands. Sissix let go and helped the old woman to her feet. They began looking through the old woman's wares. A jar of scale scrub was selected. Sissix's wrist was scanned. A few more words were exchanged, but without hand speak. A normal discussion between customer and merchant, made all the more surreal by what had come before. The old woman reached up and plucked a feather from her head, wincing as she did so. She held the feather, a faded blue, out to Sissix. Sissix took it, bowing her head low. Her expression was one of gratitude. "Oh, wow," said Kizzy, putting her hands over her heart. "I still don't know what's going on, but that just made me go all mushy." "What?" Rosemary kept her eye on Leandrisk's, as if staring long enough might provide an explanation. "What's that mean? Have you been in Sissek's room yet?" "No." "Okay, well, on her wall, there's this big, fancy frame with a mess of Andrisk feathers hanging from it. Every Andrisk's got one, as far as I know. See, if you're an Andrisk and somebody really touches your life in some way, you give that person one of your feathers. And then you keep the feathers you get from others as a symbol of how many paths you've crossed. Having a lot of feathers on your wall shows that you've had an impact on a lot of people. That's a pretty big life priority for most Andrisks, but they don't give feathers out casually, not like for helping you carry something or giving you a free drink or whatever. It's gotta be an experience that sticks with you, but it can totally be between strangers. Oh, hey, check it! Kizzy gestured with her chin towards Sissek, who was giving the old woman one of her own feathers. "Has Sissek ever given you a feather?" Rosemary asked. "Yeah. She gave me one a while back, after she got news that one of her hatch fathers died. He was old, but she was really broken up over it. I put her in the shuttle, flew her out to the middle of this nebula, and just let her yell for a few hours. I got a feather the next morning. I think the whole crew's got a Sissek's feather by now. Well, not Corbin. Probably not Corbin." Sissek's walked back over to the bench, carrying the jar of scale scrub. She looked between Kizzy and Rosemary. "I apparently have some explaining to do."
Yes,
Kizzy said. "Explaining would be great." Sissek nodded towards the road, indicating for them to follow. "A person her age should be settled down, with a house family, raising hatchlings." Rosemary tried to remember everything she'd been told about Andrisk family structure. Young Andrisks were cared for by community elders, not their biological parents. That much she knew. And there were several familial stages Andrisks went through as they aged. But beyond that, Rosemary was fuzzy on the details. "Maybe she just didn't want to," Kizzy said.
"Maybe she liked it better out here."
"No," Sissek said. "It's because she can't socialize well." "She's shy?" Rosemary asked. "She's a Rashek. There's not a word for it in Clip. She's got a disorder that makes it difficult for her to interact with others. She has trouble understanding other people's intentions. And she speaks oddly. That much was obvious when I first approached her. I offered to couple with her, but she couldn't quite bring herself around to that. So, yes, she's shy. But she also has a hard time figuring other people out. It makes her act a little, well, for lack of a better word, weird." "Why snuggle with a weirdo?" Kizzy asked. "Being weird doesn't mean that she doesn't deserve companionship. The fact that she's running a shop instead of living on a farm somewhere means that she has no house family. And, yeah, there are elders who choose not to have house families, but she doesn't even have a feather family. And that's..." Sissek shivered. "Stars. I can't imagine anything worse than that." Rosemary looked at Sissek. The familial terms were lost on her, but something clicked anyway. "You were comforting her. That's all it was. You just wanted her to know that someone cared."
"Nobody should be alone," Sissek said. "Being alone and untouched. There's no punishment worse than that. And she's done nothing wrong. She's just different."
"There are lots of other Andrisks here. Why don't they do anything for her?"
"Because they don't want to," Sissek said, her voice growing fierce. "Did you see the two Andrisks walk by while I was with her? Locals, I'm sure. They knew her. I could tell by the look in their eyes. They can't be bothered with her. She's an inconvenience." Sissek's feathers had puffed up. Her sharp teeth flashed as she spoke.
"Don't be fooled by all the warm, fuzzy talk and snuggles,"
Kizzy said to Rosemary.
Andrisks can be assholes, too.
Oh, we've certainly got our share,
Sissix said. Anyway, sorry to keep you waiting. I hope I didn't make you feel awkward. I know humans can be...
No, Rosemary said. No, it was a very kind thing to do.
She watched the Andrisk woman as she walked beside her. Her body was strange, her ways were strange, and yet Rosemary found herself in deep admiration.
Yes, awesome. Go, Sissix, Kizzy said. But I am now starving. What sounds good? Noodles? Skewers? Ice cream? We're grown-ups. We can have ice cream for lunch if we want.
Let's not, Sissix said.
Right, I forgot, Kizzy said and laughed. Ice cream makes her mouth go slack.
Sissix flicked her tongue with disapproval.
Why anyone would make freezing cold food is beyond me.
Oh, what about hoppers? Kizzy said. I could seriously go for a hopper.
Spicy peppers and crunchy onions and a big toasty bun.
She looked at Rosemary with eager eyes. I can't remember the last time I had a hopper, Rosemary said. It was a lie. She'd never had one. Grasshopper burgers were street food, and that wasn't a realm of cuisine she'd ever been privy to. She imagined how her mother would react to her chowing down a bug sandwich wrapped in greasy paper while sharing a table with modders and smugglers and arm-hacking patch thieves. She grinned. Sounds great. Ashby ran his palm down the bare torso pressing against his own. He'd had his share of lovers before her. He'd felt plenty of skin, but none like hers. She was covered in tiny scales, not thickly layered like Sissix, but seamless, interlocking. She was silvery, almost reflective, like a fish in a river. Despite all the time he'd spent looking at her, despite how comfortable he was in her company, there were still moments when the sight of her made his words stick in his throat. It was pure chance, of course, that Aelion so often managed to check all the boxes on the list of things that humans generally find attractive. On a galactic scale, beauty was a relative concept. All humans could agree that Harmagians were hideous, a sentiment the Harmagians heartily returned. Andrisks, well, that depended on who you talked to. Some people liked the feathers, others couldn't get past their teeth and claws. The Rosk, with their skittery legs and jagged mandibles, would still be the stuff of nightmares, even if they weren't in the habit of carpet-bombing border colonies. But Aeluons, by some weird fluke of evolution, had a look that made most humans drop their jaws, hold up their palms, and say, "Okay, you are a superior species." Aeluons' long limbs and digits were alien, no question, but they moved with fascinating grace. Their eyes were large, but not too large. Their mouths were small, but not too small. In Ashby's experience, it was hard to find a human who couldn't appreciate an Aeluon, even if only in the most objective aesthetic terms. Aeluon women didn't have breasts, but after meeting Pei, Ashby had found that he could do without. His teenage self would have been horrified. Lying beside her, Ashby felt like a hairy, gangly mess. But given what they'd been up to for the better part of the last 2 hours, he figured he couldn't be that repulsive. Or maybe she just didn't care about the whole hairy, gangly thing. That worked too. "You hungry?" Pei said, though her mouth did not move. Like all Aeluons, her voice was a computerized sound that came from a talk box embedded in the base of her throat. She controlled the talk box neurally, a process she likened to thinking up words while typing. Aeluons lacked a natural sense of hearing and had no need for a spoken language of their own. Among themselves, they communicated through color, specifically iridescent patches on their cheeks that shimmered and shifted like the skin of a bubble. Once they began interacting with other species, however, verbal communication became a necessity, and so talk boxes came to be.
"I'm starving," Ashby said.
He knew that as he spoke, The sounds coming from his mouth were collected by the jewelry-like implant set in her forehead. As her brain did not have any means of processing sound, the implant translated his words into neural input that she could understand. He didn't quite grasp how it worked, but he could say the same for most tech. It worked. That was all he needed to know. "Your room or mine?" he asked. That was another part of their standard operating procedure. Make sure only one person was in the room when room service arrived. Let's see what they got first. She reached over the edge of the bed and pulled the menu from a nearby table. "What are our odds?" This was an old joke between them. The question of how likely it would be that each of them would find something they liked on the room service menu. Multi-species menus meant well, but they were always hit or miss. 70-30, he said. "Your favor." "How come?" He pointed at the menu. "Because they've got a whole section dedicated to row." "Oh, so they do." He let his eyes slide down her body as she perused the selection of fish eggs. He saw something peeking up over her hip, the edge of a scar, thick and milky white. He hadn't noticed it earlier, but then he'd been a little distracted. "This one's new." "What?" She craned her neck up to look. "Oh, that. Yeah." She went back to the menu. Ashby sighed, a familiar weight growing in his stomach. Pei had many scars, corded stripes across her back, healed bullet holes on her legs and chest, a warped patch left over from the business end of a pulse rifle. Her body was a tapestry of violence. Ashby had no illusions about the risks a cargo runner faced, but somehow her neat clothes, her polished gray ship, her quick wit and smooth voice made it all seem very civilized. It wasn't until he saw physical proof that someone had hurt her that he remembered how dangerous her life was, the life he couldn't share. "Should I ask?" Ashby said, running his fingers over the dull flesh. The way she was reclining prevented him from seeing the extent of it, but it trailed all the way to her back, widening as it went. "Shit, Pei, this is huge." Pei laid the menu across her chest and looked at him. "Do you really want to know?" "Yes." "I'm not going to tell you if it's going to make you worry more." "Who said I was worried?" She stroked the creases between his eyebrows with a fingertip. "You're sweet, but you're a terrible liar." She rolled over, bringing her face to his. "There was an incident at a drop site." "An incident?" Her second pair of eyelids fluttered, and her cheeks went pale yellow with flecks of red. The intricacies of her color language were something Ashby would never be able to learn, but he was familiar enough with it to distinguish emotions. This one, for example, was somewhere between exasperated and embarrassed. "It's going to sound so much worse than it actually was." Ashby drummed his fingers against her hip, waiting. "Oh, fine. We got jumped by a small, very small, I might add, Rosk strike team. They were after the base, not us, but we got a little mixed up in it. Long, messy story short, I ended up on the top of one of their heads." "You what?" Rosk soldiers were built for combat, right down to their genes. 3 times the size of an average human. A fast, raging mass of legs and spikes and keratin plating. Given the opportunity, he didn't think he could prevent himself from running away from a charging Rosk soldier, let alone climb up on her head. "I told you this was going to sound bad. Anyway, the second to last thing she ever did was buck me off into a stack of crates. As I went crashing down, she took the opportunity to grab me in her mouth. I've got good protective gear, but Rosk jaws..." She shook her head. "What you see there on my hip is the result of one of her mandibles slicing through. But it ended up working out well for me, actually. Being in her mouth gave me a nice, soft place to shoot." Ashby swallowed. "So you..." "No, that wasn't enough to kill her. My pilot's second shot was, though... She cocked her head, second eyelids sliding in sideways. You're bothered. It's hard not to be. Ashby? She reached out to touch his cheek. You shouldn't ask. He pressed his palm against the small of her back, pulling her in close. I really want this war to be over. You know, most of this... She took his hand and guided it over her scars. Happened in GC space. This one's from an Akarak who tried to board my ship. This one's from a smuggler who didn't want me to call the authorities on his phony bots. And this one's from a Gene Tweak headcase who was just having a bad day. Nobody protects me when I'm in uncontested space. Nobody but me. With military work, I get escorts when I'm out in the open, and armed guards when I'm unloading down planetside. In a lot of ways, military work is safer, pays better too, and it's not as if they send me into heavy combat. Soon as I drop my goods, I turn right around and come back home.
Do incidents happen often?
No. She studied his face. Are you more bothered that I was attacked or that I shot someone? Ashby was quiet for a moment. The former. I don't care about you shooting that Rosk. She stretched out a leg and hooked it round one of his. That's an odd thing for an Exodon to say. Hey, like everybody else in the GC, knew that Exodons were pacifists. Before they had left Earth for the open, the refugees had known that the only way they were going to survive was to band together. As far as they were concerned, their species' bloody, war-torn history ended with them. I don't know if I can explain this, Ashby said. I wish war didn't happen, but I don't judge other species for taking part in it. What you're doing out there, I mean, I can't find fault in what you do. The Rosk are killing innocent people in territories that don't belong to them, and they won't be reasoned with. I hate saying it, but in this case, I think violence is the only option. Pei's cheeks went a somber orange. It is. I'm only on the edges of it, but from what I've seen, trust me, Ashby, this is a war that needs to be fought. She exhaled and thought. Do you think badly of me for... I don't know. For accepting business from soldiers? No. You're not a mercenary. All you do is get supplies to people. There's no fault in that. What about me shooting the Rosk, though? The one that had me in her mouth? You know that's not the first time I've had to defend myself. I know. But you're a good woman. The things you have to do don't change that. And your species... You know how to end a war. Truly end it. It doesn't get in your blood. You do what needs doing and leave it at that. Not always, Pei said. We have as many dark patches in our history as anyone. Maybe, but not like us. Humans can't handle war. Everything I know about our history shows that it brings out the worst in us. We're just not mature enough for it or something. Once we start, we can't stop. And I felt that in me, you know, that inclination toward acting out in anger. Nothing like what you've seen. I don't pretend to know what war is like, but humans, we've got something dangerous in us. We almost destroyed ourselves because of it. Pei ran her long fingers round his coiled hair. But you didn't. And you learned from it. You're trying to evolve. I think the rest of the galaxy underestimates what that says about you. She paused. Well, about the Exodons, at least, she said, her cheeks a sly green. The Solans' motives are a bit more questionable. He laughed. Not that you're biased or anything. It's your fault if I am. She propped herself up on the pillow. Don't change the subject. You haven't finished your original thought. Which one? What it is that actually bothers you. Ah, right. He sighed. Who is he to talk to her about war? What did he know about it all? Aside from news feeds and reference files, war was nothing more than a story to him. Something that happened to people he didn't know in places he'd never been to. It felt insulting to tell her how he felt about it. "Go on," she said. "The Rosk that bit you. She's dead."
"Yes."
Her tone was matter-of-fact. No remorse. No pride. Ashby nodded. "That's what bothers me."
"That a Rosk died?"
"No."
He tapped his chest.
"This. This feeling in here. That's what bothers me. I hear that you shot someone, and I'm glad of it. I'm glad that you stopped her before she could hurt you more. I'm glad that she's dead, because that means you're still here. What does that say about me? What does it say about me being relieved that you can do the thing I condemn my own species for?" Kay looked at him a long time. She pressed close to him. "It means," she said, her forehead against his, her lithe limbs wrapped round his body, "that you understand more about violence than you think." She pressed her fingers against his cheek, a touch of worry crossing her face. "And that's good, considering where you're headed." "We're not going to a combat zone. The board says the situation there is perfectly stable."
"Uh-huh,"
she said flatly. "I've never looked a Taremi in the eye, but they do not sound stable to me. That species was sending our explorers back in pieces before you guys even knew the rest of us were out here. I don't buy this alliance, and I don't like the idea of you going out there." Ashby laughed. "This coming from you."
"There's a difference."
"Really?" Her eyes shifted, displeased.
"Yes, really. I know which end of a gun to point at someone. You won't even pick one up."
She exhaled, her cheeks turning a pale orange.
"That's not fair. I'm sorry. All I mean is, I know you. I know you've probably thought this out long and hard, but I don't know the Taremi. I only know what I hear, and just please, Ashby, be careful."
He kissed her forehead. "And now you know how I feel every time you leave."
"It's an awful way to feel," she said with a smirk, "and I wish you didn't feel it either. But I suppose it's good, in a way. It means that you care for me as much as I care for you."
She placed his hand on her hip.
"I like that."
They put off room service for another hour. Day 180, GC Standard 306. The Wane. Seated safely behind the window in their quarters, Ohan gazed into the black hole. With some effort, they could remember how the galaxy had looked during their host's childhood, before infection. Flat, vacant, blank. So much of existence was lost to a mind untouched by the Whisperer. Their alien companions had such minds. Ohan pitied them. Looking only with their eyes, Ohan's view of the activity taking place along the edges of the black hole's accretion disk was no different from the way the rest of the crew saw it. A flock of unmanned skimmer drones sailed as close as they could safely get to the event horizon, just on the edge of gravity's embrace. They drifted through the whirling silt, and to the ordinary observer, they would appear to be doing nothing but drawing dust trails with their comb-like arms. But if Ohan looked with their mind, mapped it all out with the right numbers and notions, the space outside became a majestic, violent place. Around the skimmer's arms, raw energy tumbled and boiled, like a thrashing sea churning up flotsam. Tendrils of the stuff curled up around the cones, arching and writhing as they were coaxed into the collection hoppers, or so Ohan imagined. They pressed close to the window, in awe of the storm that lay beyond sight. And again, they thought of what their crewmates would see. An empty patch of space, blacker than black, and little skimmers collecting invisible cargo. How still the universe must look to their eyes, Ohan thought. How silent. That invisible cargo was what their captain had come to purchase. Ashby was probably haggling over the price of ambi cells at that very moment. Raw ambi, the stuff Ohan envisioned torquing around the skimmer combs, was difficult to gather. Ambi could be found everywhere and in everything, but the way that it weaved itself around ordinary matter made extracting it a troublesome task. With the right technology, it could be wrenched apart, but the process was so tedious and reaped such small rewards that it wasn't worth the effort. It was far easier to gather ambi somewhere where matter was already being ripped apart by forces greater than anything any sapient could build, like a black hole. Black holes were always surrounded by turbulent seas of free-floating ambi, but getting close enough to gather it posed an obvious risk. For ambi traders, the risk was worth it, especially since it allowed them to charge a premium. As expensive as ambi cells were, they were the only thing that could power the Wayfarer's interspatial bore. It was a necessary expense for a ship such as theirs, but one that always left Ashby looking a little gray afterwards. Ohan had read of ships powered entirely by ambi cells, but they had trouble conceiving of a life in which such an extravagance was affordable. Ohan picked up the razor that lay beside the wash basin near their feet. They clicked a skipping rhythm with their tongue as they trimmed the patterns in their fur. The swirls of fur and clicks of tongue meant nothing to their crewmates, but they meant everything to Ohan. Every pattern represented a cosmological truth. Every series of clicks, an abstraction of the universe's underlying mathematics. These were symbols and sounds every Cyanet pair knew. They wore the layers of the universe upon their skin, drummed its beat with their mouths. A sharp twinge blossomed deep within their wrist, and for a moment, the pair lost control of their hand. The razor slipped, nicking their skin. Ohan chirped, more out of surprise than pain. They wrapped the fingers of their other hand round the wound, rocking back and forth for a moment as the feeling faded to a quiet burn. Ohan exhaled. They looked down to the cut. Thin blood oozed forth, matting a tiny patch of fur. But the razor had not gone deep. Ohan stood stiffly and walked to the dresser in search of a bandage. This was the first stage of the wane. Stiffness and muscle spasms. Eventually, the pain would spread to their bones, and their muscles would become increasingly difficult to control. The pain would then disappear completely, but this was a devious mercy, as it indicated that their nerve fibers had begun to die. Death would come afterward, in its own time. The wane was an inevitability in a Cyanet pair's life. Though the Whisperer unlocked the mind of the host, it also shortened their life. Solitaries, blasphemous hosts that avoided infection, a crime punished by exile, reportedly could live well over 100 standards, but no pair had ever lived to be more than 30. From time to time, alien doctors would come forward, offering to help cure the wane, but they were always refused. There could be no chance of a treatment damaging the genetic stability of the Whisperer. The infection was sacred. It could not be tampered with. The wane was a fair price to pay for enlightenment. Even so, Ohan was afraid. They could disconnect themselves from the fear, but it lingered, like an unpleasant taste in the back of the throat. Fear. Such a throwback emotion, meant to spur primitive life forms away from potential predators. Life's universal constant. Every fear of rejection, of criticism, of failure, of loss. These were all caused by that same archaic survival reflex. Ohan knew that their own fear of death was nothing more than some primitive synapses firing within their host's brain, the emotional equivalent of jerking a hand away from a hot surface. When they reached for the higher parts of their mind, they knew that death was nothing to fear. Why should they fear something that came to all life forms? In some ways, having reached the Wane was a comfort to Ohan. It meant that they had been successful in avoiding a sudden, premature end. Ashby and Dr. Sheff were the only ones who knew that Ohan had begun to wane. The captain attempted to carry on as normal, though he often asked Ohan in a hushed voice how they were feeling, if there was anything he could do. Dr. Sheff, kind creature that he was, had taken the trouble to contact Cyanet doctors to learn more about the Wane's effects. A few days after the Wayfarer left Coriel, Dr. Sheff had presented Ohan with a variety of homemade tinctures and teas made from herbs recommended for easing the pain. Ohan had been touched, though as always, they did not know how to adequately express their thanks. Gift-giving was unheard of in Cyanet culture, and Ohan were always ill-equipped to express gratitude for such gestures. They believed that Dr. Sheff understood this social limitation. In a way, Dr. Sheff could see into the hearts of others as well as Ohan themselves could see the universe. Ohan often wondered if Dr. Sheff knew what a gift that was. Bandage in place and blood cleaned away, Ohan returned to the window. They picked up the razor, clicking their cheek as they dragged the blade through their fur. As they did so, they thought of the concept of purpose. Dr. Sheff's purpose was to heal and nourish. Ashby's purpose was to bind his crew together. Accepting the Wane ran contrary to those purposes. For them, accepting the death of a crew member was difficult. Ohan hoped they knew how much the effort was appreciated. Ohan's own purpose was to be a navigator, to unveil the universe for those who were blind to it. After death, Ohan would no longer be able to pursue that purpose, and they could not deny that this saddened them. At least there would be time for one more job, this new tunnel at Hedraka. The Wane had only begun its first stage. There was time for a tunnel before succumbing. Ohan hoped that Ashby was not uncomfortable with letting them embrace the Wane's final stage aboard the Wayfarer. They could think of nothing more fitting than dying in the place that housed their purpose. Ohan looked again into the black hole. They closed their eyes and pictured great swathes of fragmented matter falling and pressing endlessly. Larab, they would call it in their native tongue, a word to describe form, and Grus, too, a word for the color of unseen matter. There were no words in Klip for the colors of shapes that lay beyond sight. They had tried at times to explain these things to the Wayfarer's crew, but there were no words, no abstractions that could open their crewmates' limited minds. Ohan preferred to take in the sight alone, especially now. A black hole was the perfect place to contemplate death. There was nothing in the universe that could last forever. Not stars, not matter, nothing. The razor cut. Their wrist ached. The sky roiled, unseen.
Feed source. Reskett Museum of Natural Sciences. Archival Library. Public. Reskittkish. Item name. Thoughts on the Galaxy. Chapter 3. Author. Oshet Tekshereket. Est. Raist. As. Eas. Kirish. Isket. Ish. Kriset. Encryption. 0. Translation path. Reskittkish. Klip. Transcription. 0. Node. Identifier. 9874-457-28. Rosemary Harper.
When meeting an individual of another species for the first time, there is no sapient in the galaxy who does not immediately take inventory of their psychological differences. These are always the first things we see. How does their skin differ? Does Z have a tail? How does Z move? How does Z pick things up? What does Z eat? Does Z have abilities that I don't, or vice versa? These are all important distinctions, but the more important comparison is the one we make after this point. Once we've made our mental checklists of variations, we begin to draw parallels, not between the alien and ourselves, but between the alien and animals. The majority of us have been taught since childhood that voicing these comparisons is derogatory, and indeed, many of the racial slurs in colloquial use are nothing more than common names for non-sapient species. For example, the human term lizard to describe andrisks, the Quellen term tick to describe humans, the andrisk term search to describe Quellen. Though these terms are offensive, examining them objectively reveals a point of major biological interest. All demeaning implications aside, we andrisks do look like some of the native reptilian species of Earth. Humans do look like larger, bipedal versions of the hairless primates that plague the sewer systems of Quellen cities. Quellen do bear some resemblance to the snapping crustaceans found all over Hashkath. And yet, we evolved separately, and on different worlds. My people and the lizards of Earth do not share an evolutionary tree, nor do humans and ticks, nor Quellen and Search. Our points of origin are spread out across the galaxy. We hail from systems that remained self-contained for billions of years, with evolutionary clocks that all began at different times. How is it possible that when meeting our galactic neighbors for the first time, we are all instantly reminded of creatures back home, or in some cases, of ourselves? The question becomes even more complicated when we start to look beyond our superficial differences to the wealth of similarities. All sapient species have brains. Let us consider that seemingly obvious fact for a moment. Despite our isolated evolutionary paths, we all developed nervous systems with a central hub. We all have internal organs. We all share at least some of the same physical senses: hearing, touch, taste, smell, sight, electroreception. The grand majority of sapiens have either four or six limbs. Bipedalism and opposable digits, while not universal, are shockingly common. We are all made from chromosomes and DNA, which themselves are made from a select handful of key elements. We all require a steady intake of water and oxygen to survive, though in varying quantities. We all need food. We all buckle under atmospheres too thick or gravitational fields too strong. We all die in freezing cold or burning heat. We all die, full stop. How can this be? How is it that life, so diverse on the surface, has followed the same patterns throughout the galaxy, not just in the current era, but over and over again? We see this pattern in the ruins of the Arcanic civilization at Shesha, or the ancient fossil beds on the now barren world of Okik. This is a question that scientific communities have wrestled with for centuries, and it seems unlikely that an answer will present itself in the near future. There are many theories: asteroids carrying amino acids, supernovae blowing organic material out into neighboring systems, and yes, there is the fanciful story of a hyper-advanced sapient race seeding the galaxy with genetic material. I admit that the galactic gardener hypothesis has fueled the plots of some of my favorite science fiction sims, but scientifically speaking, It is nothing more than wishful thinking. You cannot have a theory without evidence, and there is absolutely none that supports this idea, no matter what the conspiracy theorists lurking on linking feeds would have you believe. For my part, I think that the best explanation is the simplest one. The galaxy is a place of laws. Gravity follows laws. The life cycles of stars and planetary systems follow laws. Subatomic particles follow laws. We know the exact conditions that will cause the formation of a red dwarf, or a comet, or a black hole. Why, then, can we not acknowledge that the universe follows similarly rigid laws of biology? We have only ever discovered life on similarly sized terrestrial moons and planets, orbiting within a narrow margin round hospitable stars. If we all evolved on such kindred worlds, why is it such a surprise that our evolutionary paths have so much in common? Why can we not conclude that the right combination of specific environmental factors will always result in predictable physical adaptations? With so much evidence staring us in the face, why does this debate continue? The answer, of course, is that the laws of biology are nearly impossible to test, and scientists hate that. We can launch probes to test theories of gravity and space-time. We can put rocks in pressure cookers and split atoms in classrooms. But how does one test a process as lengthy and multifaceted as evolution? There are labs today that struggle to find the funding to keep a project running for 3 standards. Imagine the funding needed to run a project for millennia. As it stands, there is no way for us to efficiently test the conditions that produce specific biological adaptations beyond the most rudimentary observations. Aquatic climates produce fins, cold climates produce fur or blubber, and so on. There have been bold attempts at creating software that could accurately predict evolutionary paths, such as the Aeluon-funded TEP-PREME project, which, though well-intentioned, has yet to unravel the mysteries of biological law. The problem with such endeavors is that there are too many variables to consider, many of which we remain ignorant of. We simply don't have enough data, and the data that we do possess is still beyond our understanding. We are experts of the physical galaxy. We live on terraformed worlds and in massive orbital habitats. We tunnel through the sublayer to hop between stellar systems. We escape planetary gravity with the ease of walking out the front door. But when it comes to evolution, we are hatchlings, fumbling with toys. I believe this is why many of my peers still cling to theories of genetic material scattered by asteroids and supernovae. In many ways, the idea of a shared stock of genes drifting through the galaxy is far easier to accept than the daunting notion that none of us may ever have the intellectual capacity to understand how life truly works. Day 245, GC Standard 306. Intro to Harmagian Colonial History. Sissix peeked round the doorframe. The hallway was empty. If she moved fast, she might make it to the medbay before anybody saw her. She hugged a bathrobe, borrowed from a pile of Kizzy's clean laundry, round herself and hurried forward. As she moved, the itch spread up from her thighs and over her belly. She rubbed her palms against it through the fabric, barely resisting the urge to dig in with her claws. She wanted to throw off the robe and roll around against the metal floor, against a rough bark tree, against a sanding block. anything, so long as she could rid herself of this dry, burning, ache, shallow, hateful itch.
Whoa, sis!
Jenks said, skidding to a halt as she rounded a corner. You almost ran me! His words stopped once he got a look at her.
Holy shit, you look terrible!
Thanks, Jenks. You're such a help, she said, continuing on her way. She wasn't embarrassed, she told herself, just angry. Yes, angry that this had happened at all. Angry at how many times in her life she'd had to put up with it. Angry at people not just leaving her the hell alone.
Sissix, hey,
Rosemary said, appearing from behind a door, scrib in hand. I was coming to see... Oh. Her dumb, wet mammal eyes widened. She brought a hand to her mouth. I'm fine, Sissix said, never pausing for a moment. With as big as the ship was, you'd think it possible for a person to get from point A to point B without constantly running into... Fuck off, Corbin! Sissix said to the pink human who had just ascended from the lower decks. He froze at the top of the staircase, looking stupid and confused as she hurried past. She burst into the medbay, shutting the door as soon as she was through. Dr. Sheff looked up from his workstation. He rumbled sympathetically.
Oh, poor girl, he said. You're molting.
I'm early, too. She glanced at herself in the mirror. Blistering pockets of dead skin had separated from her face, tearing raggedly at the edges. I didn't think I'd start for another 3 10 days, and I haven't... Ugh! The itch started up again, though it had never really stopped. Her whole face felt like it was crawling with flies. She gave in to the impulse and clawed.
Hey, now, none of that, Dr. Sheff said, coming forward to take her wrists. You'll hurt yourself.
No, I won't, Sissix said. She was acting childish, but she didn't care. Her face was about to fall off. She had a right to be petulant. Dr. Sheff pushed up her sleeve.
Really?
He said. He lifted her arm so she could see the light claw marks on her flaking skin. A faint crust of blood lingered where her claws had scratched too deep during the night.
Stars, you're parental sometimes,
Sissix mumbled. I feed you and heal you. How else am I supposed to be? Take off that robe. Let's sort you out.
Thank you.
She took off her robe as Dr. Sheff opened a storage panel. He took out a misting bottle and a Rixith, a small, flat board with a rough coating on one side. Kizzy had once called it a nail file for your entire self. Where's worst? Dr. Sheff asked. Sissix lay back on the examination table.
Everywhere, she sighed. My arms, I guess.
Dr. Sheff gently took her right arm, the one with the bloody patch, and sprayed medicated mist over it. The dry skin went translucent, lifting at the edges. He went to work with the Rixith, rubbing the wet pieces away. Sissix breathed a little easier, urging the rest of her body to be patient. Dr. Sheff took one of her fingers between his own, examining it. How's the skin feel here?
Tight. It's not ready to come up.
Oh, I think it is. It just doesn't know it yet. He moistened her skin and, with steady pressure, massaged her hand from wrist to claws. After a few minutes, she could feel an edge coming loose near her wrist. Dr. Sheff worked his fingers underneath, carefully, gripping it between two finger pads. In one swift motion, he tore the dead skin free from her entire hand, like pulling off a glove. Sissix yelped, then moaned. The new skin was sensitive, but the itch there was gone. She exhaled.
Stars, you're good at that.
I've had some practice, he said, continuing up her arm with the Rixith. Sissix craned her neck up to make sure the door was fully closed.
Do you ever get tired of humans?
On occasion. I think that's normal for anyone living with people other than their own. I'm sure they get tired of us, too.
I'm definitely tired of them today, Sissix said, laying her head back. I'm tired of their fleshy faces. I'm tired of their smooth fingertips. I'm tired of how they pronounce their R's. I'm tired of their inability to smell anything. I'm tired of how clingy they get around kids that don't even belong to them. I'm tired of how neurotic they are about being naked. I want to smack every single one of them around until they realize how needlessly complicated they make their families and their social lives and their everything. Dr. Chef nodded. You love them, and you understand them, but sometimes you wish they, and me, and Ohan too, I'm sure, could be more like ordinary people. Exactly. She sighed, her frustration simmering down. And it's not like they've done anything wrong. You know how much this crew means to me. But today, I don't know. It feels like having a mess of younger hatchmates who won't stop playing with your toys. They're not breaking anything, and you know they're only trying to please you, but they're so little and annoying, and you want them all to fall down a well, temporarily. Dr. Chef gave a rumbling chuckle. It seems your diagnosis is more complicated than just a premature molt. How so? He smiled. You're homesick. She sighed again. Yeah. We're stopping off at Hashcath before the end of the standard, right? That's not so horribly far, he said, patting her head. He stopped and rubbed one of her feathers between his finger pads. Have you been taking your mineral supplements? She glanced away. Sometimes. You need to take them all times. Your feathers are a little limp. I'm molting. Dr. Chef frowned. It's not because you're molting, he said. It's because you're deficient in the basic nutrients that every Andrisk needs. If you don't start taking your minerals regularly, I'm going to start feeding you moss paste. She made a face. The very mention of the stuff brought back childhood memories of the taste. Bitter, dusty, lingering. Okay, Hatchfather, whatever you say. Dr. Chef rumbled in thought. What? Oh, nothing. The phrase just struck me as odd, he said, his voice light. I was only ever a mother. I'm sorry, Sissix said. I didn't mean... Oh, don't. It's only true. He looked back to her, the twinkle returning to his eye. Besides, if you think of me as a parent, maybe you'll listen when I tell you to take your damn minerals. She laughed. I doubt it. There was a stretch in my childhood when my Hatch family couldn't get me to eat anything but snap fruit. She hissed as he worked the wrist against a stubborn patch on her shoulder. At least snap fruit's good for you, and somehow it doesn't surprise me that you were a willful child. He thought aloud and laughed. I bet you were a real pain. Of course I was, Sissix said with a grin. I wasn't a person yet. Dr. Chef's cheeks rippled in disagreement. Now, see, there's something about your species that I will never understand. She let out a congenial sigh. You and the rest of the galaxy, she said. Honestly, what was it about that concept that was so difficult for others to grasp? She would never, ever understand the idea that a child, especially an infant, was of more value than an adult who had already gained all the skills needed to benefit the community. The death of a new hatchling was so common as to be expected. The death of a child about to feather, yes, that was sad. But a real tragedy was the loss of an adult with friends and lovers and family. The idea that a loss of potential was somehow worse than a loss of achievement and knowledge was something she had never been able to wrap her brain around. Dr. Chef glanced over his shoulder, even though no one had entered the room. Hey, I have a confession to make. Oh? I haven't told anybody else this. This is secret. Top secret. He had lowered his voice as much as he physically could. Sissix nodded with exaggerated seriousness.
I will say nothing.
You know how you said humans can't smell anything?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've noticed that the humans aboard this ship don't smell nearly as bad as other humans.
Yeah, I've got used to them.
Wrong. He paused with dramatic importance. I routinely mix a potent anti-odor powder into the soap dispensers in the showers. I rub it into Kizzy's solid soap, too.
Sissix stared at him for a moment before crooning with laughter.
Ooh-hoo-hoo! She said, gasping for breath. Oh, you don't!
I certainly do,
he said, puffing his cheeks. I started doing it not a 10 day after I took this job. And do you know what the best part is?
They can't tell the difference.
Dr. Chef let loose an amused harmony.
They can't tell the difference.
They were both still laughing when Ashby walked through the door. His hair was wet. He had clearly just bathed. Sissix and Dr. Chef fell silent. The laughter returned, even stronger than before.
Do I want to know?
Ashby said, his eyes shifting between them.
We're making fun of humans, Sissix said.
Right, said Ashby. Then I definitely don't want to know. He nodded towards her.
Molt came early?
Yeah.
My sympathies. I'll take over your cleaning shift.
Oh, you're the best.
That was wonderful news. Cleaning products and new skin did not mix well.
Remember that next time you're laughing at us lowly primates.
Rosemary sat flicking through files in her office. Well, what passed for an office. It had been a storage room before she arrived, and technically still was, given the modest stack of crates against the far wall. The whole setup was a far cry from the sleek desk she'd had at Red Rock Transport, even as an intern, but she liked Dr. Chef's snack counter